old Facebook posts, old social media posts, and the Universal Ostrich Farms website that suggested that after 2020, when they shifted their business to this direction, they still were operating businesses in which they were selling ostrich meat, ostrich oil, which is essentially after you butcher an ostrich, they have these large fat pads on their chests that are rendered down into oil that's used to make skincare products and is also a wellness supplement. They were making pet food, they were selling ostrich leather, and so forth. This website, anyways, was available up until April of 2025, long after the outbreak and long after they'd been making claims that these ostriches were no longer available for meat. I can't verify whether or not they were selling ostrich meat to this day, but you know, it is very confusing that at least judging by those websites and social media posts, that they still did have an ostrich poultry business as well.
There's an excerpt from a recent episode of Press Progress Sources. Find out more at pressprogress.ca and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2016, the Anti-Empire Project from Toronto academic Justin Podour explores how today's empire works with a focus on the Global South. On this excerpt from a new episode, Podour explains how 1919 was the year of strikes in North America, with general strikes in Winnipeg and Seattle shaking the social and economic status quo, in a historical deep dive exploring labor and the interwar period. Now, here's Justin.
Okay, so we were just talking off mic about how we did what was a mini series about the Treaty of Versailles and all of its consequences and its critics and everything. And that mini series didn't turn out to be all that mini. It's about 15.
A little longer than we expected. Yeah.
Yeah. But that is part of our trend of covering less and less time per episode, less and less historical time per long episode, which is fine as we approach the present ever so slowly. But I guess now we are fully out of the treaty, and we're going to talk about events around the world in these years between 1919 and when does World War II really start? 1931, would you say? 1938?
Oh, 1930, I mean, in Manchuria?
Yeah, 1930. Yeah, I'd say. So we're gonna roll this interwar decade and a half or two as a separate block, and I'd say it's fair to say we have no idea how long it'll be, but
longer than we expect.
It'll definitely be in the dozens of episodes. So we're going to start with America and Canada, and we're going to talk about something we don't often talk about, but it's to the people who it's a big deal to, it's a really big deal. It's labor issues and the huge strikes of 1919 in the US and Canada. And I know there were also strikes in Britain, but I didn't actually end up researching them as I thought I would or hoped I would.
We will cover some of those probably when we get to 1924 and the first labor government.
Okay, so we'll get back to Britain now, but I think it makes a lot of sense to cover Winnipeg and Seattle 1919 together. They were understood as part of this broader movement of labor after the war. So a couple of things to start, contextual things, and I'm using Howard Zinn, of course, People's History of the United States. A lot of people's history in Howard Zinn is labor history and yes. America's violent labor history.
Highly recommended.
Yeah, very, very good book. And then Sakai Settlers, which is this, it's kind of like I think we've talked about this before, Dave. It's almost like the anti-Howard Zinn. So Howard Zinn has this belief that, it's this kind of optimistic belief that racial tensions and difficulties can be transcended if the people work together, and that America is a multi-ethnic, ultimately it's a multi-ethnic working class that is going to have a revolution one day. He's a revolutionary optimist. And Sakai is kind of like, I wouldn't call it pessimism, but I would say Sakai believes that there are, he at the beginning of the book, he says, you know, in Russia, in Tsarist Russia, the Bolsheviks called Tsarist Russia the prison of nations because there were many nations trapped inside of this Russian empire. And Sakai says, we need to understand America the same way. There's a black nation, a series of native nations, you know, a Mexican nation that was overrun in the Mexican-American War. And so he kind of analyzes it as oppressed nations. And he says, you'll never understand what's really happening unless you understand national oppression by the American empire. So he has this take, and it's interesting history, and it's an interesting take. And it's really interesting to read him and Howard Zinn together because they cover basically the same thing, the same geographic area, and the same time span. They're trying to do a history of the whole history of the United States of America. So I'll go back and forth between both, and you'll see the difference in outlook as we do. So the Nation wrote, I think this is from Zinn, the Nation wrote after the war an editorial in 1919 said about India, Korea, America, all over the place. He said the Nation editorial wrote, the common man losing faith in the old leadership has experienced a new access of self-confidence, or at least a new recklessness, a readiness to take chances on his own account. Authority cannot any longer be imposed from above. It comes automatically from below. So, you know, we can get right into the Seattle strike, but I'll just summarize it and then we'll get back into much more detail. But in September 1919, 100,000 steelworkers and 250,000 others went out on strike. Well, this is not Seattle. This is Pittsburgh, I think. The steelworkers all over. The steel strike of 1919. The AFL, American Federation of Labor Leadership, Samuel Gompers and Woodrow Wilson himself told them not to. They went out anyway. The sheriff deputized 5,000 U.S. steel employees to suppress the strike. They were not on strike, obviously. He deputized them. He announced that there would be no outdoor meetings allowed. The Interchurch World Movement reported that in Monessen, the policy of the state police was simply to club men off the streets and drive them into their homes. In Braddock, when a striker was clubbed in the street, he would be taken to jail, kept there overnight. Many of those arrested in Newcastle were ordered not to be released until the strike was over. The employers used ethnic divisions. Sherman Service Incorporated was hired by the steel corporations to break the strike and instructed its men in South Chicago. Oh, now I see this must be Sakai, actually. Instructed its men in South Chicago, we want you to stir up as much bad feelings as you possibly can between the Serbians and the Italians. Spread data among the Serbians that the Italians are going back to work. Urge them to go back to work or the Italians will get their jobs. More than 30,000... Oh, no, this is in, sorry. More than 30,000 black workers were brought into the area as strike breakers. They had been excluded from AFL unions and so felt no loyalty to unionism. I'll talk more about black workers and their, as Sakai calls it, national oppression in a minute. So after 10 weeks, the steel strike was called off by the union leadership, the National Committee. But that's not the end of the story in terms of strikes. New England and New Jersey in 1920 had 120,000 textile workers, 30,000 silk workers go on strike. The Boston police went on strike. New York City, cigar makers, shirt makers, carpenters, bakers, teamsters, and barbers. The Chicago Press reported in 1920 that there had been more strikes than ever before. So Howard Zinn's analysis was in the 1920s, the United States response was to destroy the international workers of the world, the so-called wobblies, which, again, we're going to talk a lot more about. But meanwhile, keep the economy doing well enough to prevent mass rebellion and pass immigration quotas and revive the KKK. So it was a multifaceted thing, a little bit of velvet glove, a little bit of mailed fist, or a lot of mailed fist, I guess. So in terms of improving the economy, they did that. The unemployment was 4.2 million in 1921, but it was less than 2 million in 1927. The jobs aren't great, but Millions of people were not doing badly, and they could shut out of the picture the others, the tenant farmers, black and white, the immigrant families in the big cities, either without work or not making enough to get the basic necessities. Immigration quotas. So 14 million people had come to America between 1900 and 1920. That's a pretty big percentage of how many Americans there were total at that time. Mm-hmm. New quotas. The new quotas were 100 Africans a year, 100 Chinese, Bulgarians, and Palestinians per year, 34,000 from England or Northern Ireland, 3,800 from Italy, 51,000 from Germany, 124 from Lithuania, 28,500 from the Irish Free State, and 2,200 from Russia, Soviet Russia.
How many from Japan?
I don't know. None?
Zero.
Yeah, none.
Zero.
And there were a lot of Japanese workers in, especially in California and Hawaii already.
Yes. I think
we've discussed this by now. So there is, they're closing the door on a community that had already had quite a few Japanese Americans. And there are weird things with strikes where the unions ask the Japanese workers to come to meetings as non-voting members and, to respect the strike, but not be, getting involved. And it was pretty, pretty bad. Pretty bad treatment by the unions, too, of Japanese Americans. Mm. The KKK expanded to 4 million members by 1924. That's probably much more than the KKK has today.
Yes.
Who knows? But
well, we'll have an episode coming up where we will deal with them in more detail.
So it's a gilded age, as they say. Manufacturing wages are going up about 1.4% a year between 1922 and 1929. Meanwhile, stocks are going up 16.4% per year. So if you own stocks, you're pretty happy. Not a lot of people do. 6 million families, or 42% of the total, make less than $1,000 a year, but 40% make more than $2,000 a year and can buy cars, radios, refrigerators, etc. All these new gadgets. The top 0.1%, so the top 0.1% of families, were receiving the same amount of income as 42% of the bottom of workers. There were about 25,000 workers killed on the job and 100,000 permanently disabled every year in the 1920s. That's pretty high. 2 million people in New York City lived in housing that was described as rat traps. And you couldn't find out a lot about this because almost all the chief avenues to mass opinion were now controlled by large-scale publishing industries. So this is a monopoly. Remember all the propaganda techniques that they had mastered during World War I. And they brought this all to bear to fight against the working class of America. Women can vote in 1920, but, the political issue, like labor, bringing labor in as a political issue, is pretty hard to do. And voting seems to be a middle class and upper class activity at this time for women, too. The Secretary of the Treasury is Andrew Mellon, one of the richest men in America. He publishes a tax plan called the Mellon Plan in 1923. It reduces the top income tax from 50 to 25%. And the lowest income group also gets tax relief. Their taxes go from 4% to 3%. Mm. Personally, saving Mellon $800,000 on his own income tax bill and his brother $600,000 on his income tax bill. Keep it in the family. Don't hate the player, hate the game, I guess. Coal and railway strikes in 1922 and a textile strike that failed in 1922 in Rhode Island. So the Communist Party is organizing, the CPUSA, and they're challenging the American Federation of Labor. One organizer, Ben Gold, stood up at a AFL meeting and challenged the chair and the AFL and was knifed and beaten by other AFL members for his trouble. But under Ben Gold's leadership, he recovered from the stabbing and led a furrier's strike, which won under his leadership in 1926. There was a textile strike in 1929 in the Carolinas and in Tennessee. And these workers got into a shootout with police, killing the chief of police in Gastonia, resulting in 16 strikers being indicted for murder. Some of these communists strikers were released on bail and escaped to Soviet Russia.
Just a word here on the AFL, the American Federation of Labor, was set up to negotiate on behalf of all workers. And as you say, Samuel Gompers was the well-known head. His policy was not to strike, not to have negotiations. It was to ask.
There's a highlight from the ANSI Empire Project with Justin Podour. Find it at podour.org and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcasing, your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. And finally, Aaronson's 2020, the Jack Webster Award-winning Cited, is a documentary podcast series telling stories about the politics of science and expertise, with hosts Gordon Caddick in Toronto and Marco Pagliano in Hamilton. On this episode from the new season, Green Dreams, the team explore the concept of ecological civilization, which combines elements of traditional Chinese culture and eco-Marxism, with In Search of Green China author Ma Tianji. Now, here's the show.
I'm Gordon Caddick, and this is Cited. You'll remember that our second episode of this season was about the development of sustainable development. That is the reigning green dream out here in the West. But like I said on that episode, it's not a dream that has delivered a more sustainable world just yet. Could there be a better way? Sustainable development has one major challenger from out east. It's called ecological civilization. That was first proposed in the Soviet Union in the 1980s. Now it's the reigning green dream of the Communist Party of China. Ecological civilization bills itself as a radical step beyond sustainable development. It's not just about sustaining our existing order, but fundamentally changing it. It proposes a cultural, social, and economic transformation to produce a new world order, one that transcends industrial civilization and replaces it with ecological civilization. The person most responsible for this green dream is somebody named Pan Yu. Pan Yu was a journalist throughout the 1980s and into the early 90s, and while doing that, he had a firsthand look at a number of China's major environmental disasters. He then went on to become a party researcher and bureaucrat in the mid-90s. He quickly rose the CCP ranks, and in 2003, he became a deputy director at the State Environmental Protection Administration. Eventually, he became their chief spokesperson. Pan was widely celebrated as an environmental dove, especially by the international press. In 2008, The Guardian called him a hero, and they named him one of the 50 people who could save the planet. Through a series of his journalistic writings, policy reports, and public speeches, Pan developed and popularized the idea of ecological civilization, and it took off. Concurring with Pan's rise, ecological civilization steadily rose to become a central plank of the CCP's ideology. President Hu Jintao first put it forward in 2007. It was then elevated as a core objective in 2012, and in 2018, President Xi Jinping made it one of China's major constitutional principles.
70 years on, under the leadership of the Communist Party of China, China is now the world's second largest economy, engaging actively with almost every country on earth. In this special...
This is Robert Lawrence Kuhn, an American investment banker and TV producer who has been working in China since the 90s. He's the star of a CGTN propaganda series that examines the history of the party. On the third episode of that series, he interviews Pan Yu through a translator.
Ecological civilization is a critical part of socialism with Chinese characteristics for the new era.
What is the theoretical sources for ecological civilization?
In a nutshell, there are three theoretical sources of an ecological civilization. First, it is a Marxist ecology. Marx once said that a harmonious development between man and nature depends on transformed relations between man and man, and man and society. The second is China's traditional culture, which calls for he-he, cooperation and harmony between man and nature, and see them as a harmonious whole.
Just like sustainable development, the prescriptions of ecological civilization are somewhat vague. In practice, it's become a mix of developmental environmentalism, environmental nationalism, and some small experiments in steady-state economics. Pan also championed a number of major green policy reforms, including a green GDP and China's first major environmental impact assessment law. Between 2005 and 2007, those impact assessments resulted in the slowdown of more than 110 large-scale industrial projects. To learn about the story of ecological civilization, I turn to Ma Tianji. Tianji is author of the new book, In Search for Green China. He's a longtime journalist and environmental activist based in Beijing. This episode is going to be an extended interview with Tianji. In Search of Green China recounts the story of Pan Yu and the birth of China's modern environmental movement. Pan developed ecological civilization alongside a growing cadre of environmental activists, journalists, and bureaucrats. But Tianji also recounts the struggle over ecological civilization. In 2008, Pan was largely sidelined by the party. Now, ecological civilization has become a site of political struggle and contestation. In its more radical articulations, the idea looks like a call for an engaged green citizenry that would live in harmonious relation with the land. And it also suggests a fundamental rethink of Chinese society and, indeed, our world. But in its more conservative articulations, the idea looks like nothing more than ideological cover for muscular eco-authoritarianism, for naive techno-solutionism, and also for bellicose nationalists waging a new Cold War where climate politics is just another front. So is eco-civilization a green dream worth pursuing, or just another green nightmare best avoided? After the break, I speak with Ma Tianji about China's reigning green dream. Where does your water come from? What does it really mean to break up with fossil fuels? And what could life in 2100 actually look like? These big questions and more are at the heart of The Climate Dispatch. That's a new podcast from the Sierra Club's Los Angeles chapter, made in collaboration with Stranded Astronaut Productions. The Climate Dispatch explores the climate crisis from both global and local perspectives through the lens of life in Southern California. Hosted by Taya Jeanette, the show features intimate, thought-provoking conversations with leading voices in the climate movement. Together, they share hard truths, hopeful visions, and real wins from the front lines of climate action. Plus, each episode ends with performances from LA-based musicians. Tune in to The Climate Dispatch at sc.org/climatedispatch or wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, back to our regular scheduled programming. Ma Tianji is a journalist and environmental activist based in Beijing. His career coincides with the development of modern Chinese environmentalism. For a long time, CCP leaders debated whether environmental problems were even possible in China. They claimed that these problems were just the products of corrupt capitalist societies. But it was obvious to Tianji that that just can't be true. During his studies in the late 90s and early 2000s, he became a prominent environmentalist. After graduating, he became one of the first members of Greenpeace's China office, and he eventually became their program director. He then went on to become director of China Dialogue, There, he reported on Chinese environmental politics. He's also a frequent contributor to a range of publications, both domestic and international, including CGTN, South China Morning Post, and Foreign Policy. Tianji's book, In Search of Green China, begins around a particular place, the Huai River, a place that rapidly industrialized.
So that was in the early mid-90s. And that was really the result of, I think, China's first round of economic liberalization after the Cultural Revolution, when Deng Xiaoping opened the economy, right, to the world and allowing basically private enterprises, right, to prosper across the country. And a few particular things that Deng Xiaoping did, which were basically credited, right, for the Chinese economic miracle, for the Chinese economy to take off, is first of all creating this really strong incentive system for every level of local governments, right, to become basically business developers. So in the Huai River Basin, what they did was they set up all kinds of like paper mills, right, or food processing plants that can use the agricultural produce of their provinces and to upgrade the economy into more industrialized ones. But the problem is that the technologies, right, those little enterprises they use were really primitive. So there was no attention paid to the environmental consequences, the effluents and all those pollutions they're creating, because everybody was just in this mode of get rich fast. So very quickly, the river became kind of a sewage for like four very large provinces. And by mid-1990s, it became really kind of an awful scene. The newspapers and sort of writers around that time were documenting really stunning stories. One of the stories I always had in my mind was the blinded monkeys, right? So there was, in the middle of the river, there was a little island, and there used to be a zoo there, right, with a bunch of monkeys raised there. But because the ammonia nitrogen in the river was so strong, right, and the one effect these ammonia nitrogen have is on membranes, on eye membranes, right, and you literally have monkeys blinded by the river. And that is the kind of story that everybody, like, it's so common in the river basin at the time. And it was, I think, first time that people heard the concept of cancer village.
There's a highlight from a new episode of Cited. Find the archives at citedmedia.ca, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcasing, your local campus and community radio station. This episode's been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's coalition of more than 30 progressive publishers and get all your independent Canadian journalism, news, videos, and podcasts in one place at unrigged.ca. Follow us on Twitter at Harbinger Tweets and on Instagram at Media Harbinger, and now on Blue Sky and Substack for updates on new episodes. And subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 83 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now, back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser University Radio, streaming on the internet at cjsf.ca. Hey, you're listening. Should I say I'm Jan Arden?
Yeah, that might be a good idea.
Yeah. Okay.
Community radio can't exist without community. Our listeners and supporters make this possible. My name is Danny Nesvedarani, host of Analog Archives, and I am urging you to support CJSF 90.1 FM, your community radio station, with a donation to Fundrive at cjsffunddrive.ca or by texting donate to 778-782-2573 right now. Your support is so important and so appreciated.